If you were unable to attend this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, we have good news for you. We produced an audio DVD of the conference. The recording contains all of the speakers' presentations, my Divine Service sermon, and the hymn sing. We'll send you the audio DVD for a donation of $300 to Issues Etc. before Labor Day. Click the audio DVD logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or you can also order by check. Make your $300 check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Order your audio DVD of the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. One of the promises of the sexual revolution to women was that they could have it all. Now, I don't know exactly what that meant. Maybe we'll find out here in the course of the next half hour. I wonder, can anyone have it all? Women were told that they could have it all, kind of based upon the assumption that men already did or could. Is that true? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Tuesday afternoon. It's the 28th of July. We're going to continue our weekly series with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse of the Ruth Institute, talking about the sexual revolution today, the problems of the career woman, sex education, and cohabitation. A little bit later, Dr. John Eastman will join us, professor of law and community service at Chapman University in Orange, California. We'll find out whether or not homosexual rights and religious freedom can coexist in American law and in American society. Our call-in number for the next hour, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or our beloved on-demand listeners, wherever and whenever you listen, feel free to use the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us for part three of our weekly series on the sexual revolution, talking about the problems of the career woman in sex education, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, founding president of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she's author of the new book, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
When the early advocates of the sexual revolution promised women that they could have it all, what were they saying?
Well, they were telling women that you could have a job, a great career, an education, and children as long as you agreed to play by certain rules. But they never quite mentioned the rules, Todd. You know, the rules turned out to be that you can participate in higher education and the labor market as long as you agree to chemically neuter yourselves during your peak childbearing years and then agree to put your children in daycare during their tender years. As long as you agree to that, you can have it all.
Was there an assumption that men already did have it all?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was an assumption that men had it all because men were fathers and had jobs, and in some cases very high-powered jobs, because don't forget that the sexual revolution, especially this part of the sexual revolution, was highly driven by the educated classes. Educated women, their husbands in high-powered jobs and so on. And so what they were saying was that, you know, my husband who has a great job and a big law firm and has four children, he has it all. But what they forgot to mention was that the way he had it all was that he's the father of those children, but he's not interacting with them in an intimate day-to-day way, the same way that their mother is, particularly when the children are really small. So there was this kind of assumption that having children was kind of all one thing without really looking too closely at what it means to be a hands-on mom or a hands-on dad or a really involved dad or a moderately involved mom or dad, or and that many of the husbands of the women of the educated classes, their husbands were not really very involved. Their husbands were really preoccupied completely with their careers. So the slipperiness of the definition of these terms is part of what made the promise of having it all seem to be plausible. But in fact, when you actually tried to live it out, you found out that women have 24 hours in a day and men have 24 hours in a day. And everybody has to make responsible decisions about how to spend their time and what to have as their highest priority. And the reality is everybody gets one and only one top priority at each and every time in their lives. You can have different top priorities at different times in your life, but there's only one first at any given time. And this is the thing. This is, all of those kinds of considerations were completely obscured by the feminists who were talking about having it all.
So what has actually, what has been the payoff of the promise as of today when the sexual revolution said, women, you can have it all? What's actually, what has actually been delivered to women?
Well, you know, it was really, in a sense, an empty promise. It was a whole set of empty promises. I mean, we could actually retitle this series, Todd, The Empty Promises of the Sexual Revolution, right? Because the sexual revolution promised that you could have a husband, have children, have a high education, have a career, and you could have all of that simultaneously and never have to sacrifice anything. But the reality is that some women have been able to have high education and pretty good jobs and be married and stay married and take care of their kids. And many other women have ended up taking care of kids completely on their own because they haven't been able to form or sustain relationships. And many other women had no children, ended up having no children. Women who thought that they were going to have it all and then became 35 or 40 and looked around them and realized, hey, wait a minute, if I don't get on it, I'm not going to have any kids. And some of them were unable to have kids. And those women are deeply disappointed and really, in a sense, have been defrauded by the sexual revolution.
Well, what's been, just so we can tie up all our loose ends, what's been the result for men with the promise?
Well, that's very interesting. What's been the result for men? One thing that is pretty well known is that the wages of men, particularly working class men, has fallen relative to women, and their employment rates have fallen. And so the economic opportunities for men have shifted quite a bit, and not in a favorable way. Men don't have the sense that they're needed in the family in the same way that they once did. They don't have the sense that they're important. And so for many men, they're kind of flailing. They don't know what to do. They don't know what to do with themselves. They don't know what's expected of themselves. And so for some men are doing okay. The highly educated professional class of men, what we might call the managerial class, they're doing okay. The guys in that class are doing okay. Those people get married and stay married. They have a tendency to do that. I think we've talked about this before, Todd, that the college-educated people pretty much act like leave it to Bieber and Father Knows Best. They get married, they stay married, they don't have children out of wedlock. The only difference with that class today and in the 1950s is that today they get started, they get married 10 years later, roughly, than June and Ward Cleaver got married. And during that 10-year period, they're not living chaste lives. During that 10-year period, they're contracepting and sometimes aborting in order to delay childbirth until they finally do get married to the, you know, to the right mate and all of that type of stuff. But people with less education, people who have less career-oriented reason to postpone childbearing, for those people, their lives have become chaotic, you might say. Their family lives have become much more difficult, much more complicated, because, you know, people do get pregnant when they're having sex. I mean, that's a fact. People get pregnant, but people haven't had the same caution about the choice of partner when you think that you can just have sex as a recreational matter. And so there's much more relationship churning in the less educated classes where people are having sex, having babies, maybe getting married, maybe not getting married, maybe cohabiting, maybe moving in and out. A lot of instability among the classes of people who have the fewest resources financially to deal with all the problems that that creates. So in a sense, you could say that what the sexual revolution has done has been to increase the economic and social inequality that we already had in society so that the people who are toward the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder have more difficulty moving up the ladder, and their children have more difficulty competing with the children of the educated classes because they don't have the family stability and the economic resources to do that successfully.
You write this, you say, I believe that the women's movement has missed some opportunities. We could have humanized the workplace instead we have bureaucratized the home. What do you mean by that?
Well, that article that you're quoting from, this book that we're talking about, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims, the articles in that book I've written over a period of 20 years. That's the oldest, that article you just quoted from is the oldest article in the books. I wrote it 20 years ago. And at that time, Todd, I was still trying to do everything exactly equally with my husband. I still had it in my mind that the right thing to do in married life was for me to do half of everything and for him to do half of everything. And if he didn't do half of the chores, I was entitled to nag him, be disappointed with him, resent him. I was entitled to all of that. And so in my mind, what I meant by bureaucratizing the home at that point was, in my mind, I had this spreadsheet going, you know, of what he did and what I did. And in my mind, I was, you know, redoing the accounts on a regular basis, you know. And that's what I meant by bureaucratizing it. What I didn't know then was just how much the culture of divorce has actually literally bureaucratized the home. You know, that was a metaphorical bureaucratization that I was talking about. But the divorce courts, in a sense, literally bureaucratize the home, because the family court will be supervising the many aspects of family life in order to equalize things between the father and the mother, if they've got to, you know, somehow negotiate these problems that the parents can't settle themselves. The family court gets involved with figuring out who the kid's going to spend time with, how much time they're going to spend time with each parent, and how the money's going to be allocated. And that requires the court to look into the details of how they're spending their money, who's earning it. All of these kinds of things become the subject of the court system, which in a functioning household, you would never dream of letting an agent of the government sit in the backseat of your minivan listening to you chat it up about what you're going to spend your money on, you know. But now many families do have to deal with that. And that, to me, is one of the great untold stories about the sexual revolution and its consequences.
I find it interesting, that term sandwich generation, you deal with it in one of your essays. And we use it loosely, but strictly speaking, we're talking about people who have kids that are dependent on them, even while their parents are growing dependent on them. And you say the reason we have that phenomenon is because we didn't do the math, largely dealing with delayed childbirth. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, you know, when you think about it, everybody has a sandwich, right? Every responsible adult has little children who are dependent on them and elderly relatives who are dependent on them. The difference in our generation, we thought we discovered this whole new thing of being a sandwich. The difference is we have them at the same time, you know, and the reason we have them at the same time is because we postponed having our first child for so long that our parents, that while we're aging, our parents are aging too. And so the children and the parents need attention at the same time. Whereas if you had your children when you were in your early 20s, and your parents did likewise, you know, when you have your first children, your parents are, you know, maybe 50. They're not infirm. You know, they're not in the nursing home. They're not needing diapers themselves, you know, this kind of thing. And so in a sense, we did it to ourselves. We didn't do the math. In fact, years ago, my daughter asked me when she was a teenager, actually, she was about 10 or 12, my daughter asked me, you know, Mom, how old should I be when I have my first child? And so I asked her, well, honey, you know, how old was I when you were born? You were 38, Mom. Okay. So now if you wait till you're 38, how old will I be when you have your first child? She does the math. Okay. You will be 76. I said, okay, honey. So, you could do it that way, but then you may have your child and me in diapers at the same time. You do whatever you want, but that's what the math tells you, that's what you're risking. And, you know, that's the math we didn't do, we baby boomers. We didn't think about our parents aging.
And did you think about yourself aging too?
We didn't think about our fertility declining as we aged, right? even though doctors were trying to tell us, you know, you really should get on with it here. You don't want to put it off forever. That became so politically incorrect that doctors were afraid to say that to us, you know, because we'd give them the stink eye and, you know, look at them bad and stuff like that. So the doctors were like, well, okay, whatever, whatever, you know. And so we didn't think about ourselves aging. We didn't think about our parents aging. We literally didn't do the math, you know, that would have told us that that there's a reason that you have cultural norms around first childbirth, you know, getting underway in your 20s, you know. We kind of threw away all of the accumulated cultural wisdom around that stuff.
One other question on that, then we'll take a break. You say that delaying childbirth didn't necessarily result in delayed gratification. What do you mean by that?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, while we were delaying our childbearing, it's not as if we were all living chaste lives during that time. You know, most of us, myself included, you know, we had 5, 10, 15 years of contraceptive sex. And so that meant we were enjoying ourselves sexually, never taking the adult responsibility for the consequences of sexuality, which is mean you might have a baby, you could have a baby, sometimes you do have a baby, and then you have to, you know, deal with those consequences of having children. And so what we did as a whole generation was to allow ourselves, indulge ourselves in contraceptive sex for all of those years. Then when we start our families at the age of 35 or 40, all of a sudden we look around and go, gee, this is harder than we thought because we've got grandma over here and we've got the new baby over here. And I don't remember my mom being this stressed out. What the heck is going on here? You know, it's like it's a big surprise. But the fact is we kind of had our fun and now we pay for it, you know. The problem with it is that as a whole generation, we're paying and paying and paying. And by the time you figure out that there was something wrong with that equation in the first place, it's too late for you to go back and fix it. And I guess that's what I would like to say to younger women. And that's what I hope this book will do for younger women and for younger men, too, is to see that if you follow what the world is teaching you and postpone your marriage and childbearing until you're 35 or 40, when you do that, there are costs that you're going to pay, and the culture is not telling you about those costs. The culture is telling you that it's all going to be great. You'll have the baby exactly during the month that you have set aside for it, and it will all be fine, and your mom will still be there, and you'll have a nanny, and it's just all going to work out. By the time you figure out that that's not true, it's too late to go back and do anything about it. So that's what I hope this book will help people to see, Todd.
Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse is our guest, founding president of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California, and author of the new book, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. We've got another 10 minutes or so with her on the other side of the break. Stay tuned.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Hey, St. Louis. How would you like to achieve your fitness goals in a fun and supportive atmosphere? Hi, this is Kevin Reisick, owner and operator of Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois. We offer adult boot camps throughout the week. These camps include cardiovascular conditioning, muscular strength and endurance training, balance and coordination activities, and more. For more information, give me a call at 618-670-6952, Arch Fitness of East Alton, Illinois, 618-670-6952.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you have a hard time finding Christian greeting cards and gifts that aren't either sappy or theologically suspect? Ad Crucem offers the perfect combination of art and the truth of the scriptures with beautiful and reverent greeting cards and gifts. Deliver the true comfort of the gospel, Christ crucified for sinners, to family and friends with Ad Crucem. ADCRUCEM.com. Confessing the faith through art and word. AdCrucem.com.
There are nearly 20 million college students in the United States. 40% will stop going to church during college. 50% will never return. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is seeking to meet this challenge through LCMSU. Why? Because 100% of college students matter to God and to His church. College is tough. You need Jesus. We'll help. LCMSU. Check us out at lcms.org/lcmsu.
Let me tell you about the birds and the bees and the flowers and the trees and the moon up above and a thing called love.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse is our guest. It's part three of our weekly series with her on the sexual revolution. Today, we're moving on to talk about sex education and cohabitation. All right, sex education is a, I think you could call this, if it's not a third rail in the conversation, it's close to the third rail somehow. It's a pretty touchy subject. How do you sort that one out? I mean, we have extremes on both sides, but how do you sort that one out?
Well, you know, my basic perspective, this is an area where my libertarian instincts continue to resonate in my heart, Todd, because I cannot figure out for the life of me how it ever got to be any of the government's business to be teaching small children about sex. I mean, is this John Locke's idea? Is this Thomas Hobbes's idea? Is this Thomas Jefferson's idea? I mean, whoever came up with the idea that the government and its agents should be teaching children how to put condoms on a banana? I mean, where are the libertarians when we need them? You know what I mean? I just can't get why this is even taking place in the classroom at all. Once you start with that perspective, then the question of exactly what should be taught, well, you know, that's kind of a secondary question. It's an important question. But let's just pause before we even get started on the details. Why is the government in sex ed at all? That's my question.
What was the rationale for the introduction of formal sex ed classes that, I mean, now it's become, in extreme cases, it's become not just basic human sexuality. It's become, you know, we have to teach them about every deviant behavior as well, because they got to have a well-rounded knowledge of these things.
Well, Todd, truthfully, honestly, I think from the beginning, sex ed in the schools has been part of the propaganda of the sexual revolution. The point of having sex ed, I was being sort of rhetorical a minute ago, you know, that the people who thought it was the government's business were people who had a particular view of human sexuality that they wished to impart, that they want everybody to go along with, and which is not, in fact, the view of most people in America. Even today, most parents would prefer that this stuff not be taught in their schools. And if you left it to them, they'd do it at home. They wouldn't do these kind of programs, you know. And so I view the whole sex education establishment as being simply a propaganda arm of the sexual revolution. And when you talk about abstinence educators, you know, it's not quite fair to say that abstinence education is on one extreme and teaching children about homosexuality in kindergarten is on the other extreme. That's not quite fair, in my opinion. In my opinion, the abstinence educators are trying to do a rearguard action, trying to clean up the mess after this thing that has been created by the propaganda arm of the sexual revolution. Most of the people that I know who are involved in abstinence education would be perfectly happy to go home and teach their own kids, you know, and let other families do the same thing, you know. It's just that once the government decides that this is its job to create a certain sexual culture through educating kids in the schools, once they decide that, people who don't agree with what they're teaching have got to get themselves on the field and be organized and fight against it. So it isn't fair at all to say that these two sides are somehow equivalent or extreme versions. You know, they're both on the same continuum, one's at one end, one's at the other. That's not really quite fair, I think.
Okay, so first of all, we're going to establish that the government doesn't need to be worrying about either sex education or abstinence education, that that belongs more in hearth than it does in classroom. And really just ask the government to demonstrate some interest. In other words, they have to demonstrate they have an interest in doing this kind of a thing. When it comes
right.
to, is there a conflict? And I'm not talking here about what passes for sex education now. But in an ideal world, is there a conflict between education in human sexuality and abstinence education?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. One can... Every family used to teach exactly education in human sexuality plus abstinence. You know, that was the norm. That here is what sex means. Here is what human sexuality is all about. Here is what it means. Here's how you're supposed to behave. Here's how good people behave. This is what our family does. And by the way, everybody around you, this is pretty much what we're doing. And teaching the mechanics of sex is not nearly as important or as interesting as teaching the meaning of sex. And truthfully, the advocates of the sexual revolution know that very well. They claim they're teaching the mechanics of sex and they're value neutral. But in point of fact, they are imparting, both implicitly and explicitly sometimes, they are imparting a set of values and a certain view of the meaning of human sexuality just by the way they're presenting themselves and the way they're presenting their so-called mechanical value-neutral information. There's nothing neutral about it. It's not possible to be completely neutral on a subject like that.
Well, I think it's more accurate. I don't know what you think about it. Rather than they claim value neutrality, I think what they really mean is value-free.
Well, you know, Todd, even that value-free, you know, they have some values. They're promoting some values. You know, I think they really believe that everybody needs to be sexual, is entitled to be sexual, and that being sexual without a live baby resulting is an entitlement. And that if you don't have sex, you know, I'm sure not everybody involved in sex education believes exactly this, but there certainly are people in our culture who believe that if you don't have sex, there's either something wrong with you or something's going to be wrong with you. You know, you're repressing yourself, it's not healthy, and so on and so forth. I think a lot of people do have those kinds of views, and which are values. Those are not scientific views. You know, it's a scientific fact that sexual abstinence is not fatal. You know, you're not going to die if you don't have sex. That's a scientific fact. But I think some people who... are committed to certain kinds of sex ed, I'm not sure they're convinced of that, you know?
Dr. Jennifer Roback-Morris is founding president of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. She is author of the book, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims. You can find out more about this new book under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Jennifer, thank you very much, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
When we come back, we're going to turn to the issue of homosexual rights and religious freedom. Can these proceed in American law and society on parallel tracks, or do they cross and lead to dangerous collisions? We're going to take up that question with Dr. John Eastman, professor of law and community service at Chapman University in Orange, California, on the other side of the break.
This is the day which the Lord has made.
Listen to chapel services live weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana at issuesetc.org. Morning chapel from Kramer Chapel, live weekday mornings 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Yes, there is a Messiah in Seattle. Messiah Lutheran Church and Concordia Lutheran School have served North Seattle for over 60 years, and we invite you to join us on Sunday mornings at 8 and 10:45 with Bible study at 9:20. Messiah Seattle is proud to support Issues, etc. To learn more, watch our adult information class videos online or on DVD. Our website is messiahseattle.org, 206-524-0024.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com. lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/lutheracademy.
Steadfast Lutherans. People who believe the law condemns everyone and should be preached to the fullest. People who believe the gospel is for everyone and should be preached to its sweetest. Traditional Lutheran doctrine and practice deliver every Sunday this law and gospel, that Christ was crucified for us sinners. To all who received him, who believed in his name, the Gospel of John says, he gave the right to become children of God. To see how Steadfast Lutherans preserves this good news for everyone, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
Where Christianity meets culture. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.